May it please the court, I am George Warner, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the Texas Real Estate Commission. This case is a claim for payment out of the Real Estate Recovery Fund, which was established by the legislature in 1975 for reimbursing aggrieved persons who suffer actual damages by reason of certain acts committed by licensed real estate agents. I have provided the court with a pamphlet copy of the Real Estate License Act open to Section 8 of that statute, which is the section of the Real Estate Recovery Fund. As the court noted in its Pace decision in 1983, Part 1A of Section 8 describes the damages that are to be paid out of the fund, while Part 3 describes the procedures that are to be followed in order to press a claim. In this case, Fontaine Graham, a licensed real estate broker in El Paso, was appointed as the co-executrix of the estate of Martha Neal, and for some period of years, she managed and handled the estate's affairs, including its real property. The descendants of Martha Neal, Wesley Nagel and others, sued her, alleging certain acts of misconduct, and recovered a judgment against her in El Paso for an amount in excess of $100,000. They then sought payment of that judgment out of the Real Estate Recovery Fund. The trial court ordered the commission to pay, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. This court initially denied our application for writ of error, but on motion for rehearing, granted it to consider the question whether the requirements of the statute had been met, the procedures had been followed, entitling one to payment from the fund. In establishing the recovery fund, the legislature took what is two separate actions and tacked one on top of the other. The first or underlying action involves the victim, consumer, and the real estate broker. The second action involves the victim, consumer, and his application for payment out of the recovery fund. The legislature authorized the applicants, after they got their judgment against the broker, on certain grounds involving fraud, misrepresentation, and the like, if they could not obtain satisfaction of that judgment out of the broker's assets, to file a verified claim in the court which rendered the judgment and give notice to the state, to the Texas Real Estate Commission, by certified mail. Now, the legislature attempted to streamline the procedures. They didn't require, for example, the applicants to file a separate lawsuit with additional filing fees and personal service, but authorized the verified claim to be filed in the same court that rendered the judgment with notice to the commission and to the judgment debtor by certified mail. But in these two separate actions, you have different parties, and you also have different issues. The underlying action is against the broker, and the liability of the broker is determined. In the action against the recovery fund, the liability of the state of Texas, the Texas Real Estate Commission, and the requirements of Section 8 of the statute are the issues. The commission is not a party to the underlying action, and the issues of the state's liability out of the fund are not the focus of the court in that underlying action. The Court of Appeals of El Paso itself, in its 1980 Century 21 decision, said that the claim for payment out of the recovery fund is separate and apart from the underlying action against the broker. The procedures that the legislature established are specifically listed in Part 3 of Section 8. In Part 3, you see that in Section 3C, the application must be heard at a recovery fund hearing. And the statute says on the hearing, on the application, the aggrieved person is required to show that, and then it lists several items. Please note that the burden is placed on the aggrieved person at the recovery fund hearing to show why he is entitled to be paid by the state. What must he show at this recovery fund hearing? Several items are listed, the first of which is that the judgment is based on facts allowing recovery under Part 1A of this section. Again, note it doesn't say he is required to show that he has a judgment, period. Not only must he have a judgment, but he also must show that that judgment is based on facts allowing recovery under Part 1A. Part 3B authorizes the court to order the commission to pay if the court is satisfied on the hearing, the recovery fund hearing, of the truth of all matters required to be shown by the aggrieved person by Part 3C of this section, and that the aggrieved person has satisfied all of the requirements of Parts 3B and C of this section. Part 5 says that when the Real Estate Commission receives notice of entry of a final judgment in the underlying cause and a recovery fund hearing is scheduled, the Commission contacts the Attorney General and indicates whether it wants the Attorney General to enter an appearance, file a response, and then it says, defend the action. What action? The recovery fund action. Because the entire Part 5 is premised on the final judgment in the underlying cause already having been entered. Now, what happened in this case? When I went to El Paso, I went prepared to argue basically the question of law in this case, the extent of the reach of the exemption. Ms. Graham was acting as an executor, and the statute specifically exempts from its provisions executors of estates. Being exempt, she simply could not perform in the capacity of a real estate broker in reference to the handling of the affairs and the real property of this estate. When I arrived, I was told by Mr. Larry Hicks, the attorney for the Nagels, that he had a judgment, that he had findings, and that I was bound by them, that I could not collaterally attack him. And his position was that once he got his judgment against the broker, the state was bound, and that was the end of it. It was sort of like being invited to participate in an athletic contest, and even though you suit up and you show up, when you arrive, they tell you that you're not going to be able to participate, that the game is over, and that you lost. At the hearing, Mr. Hicks requested the court to take judicial notice. But if we look carefully at the record, I think the record shows that he asked the court to take judicial notice of three very limited facts: that there was a judgment against Fontaine Graham, the amount of the judgment, and the date. We had no objection and concede those facts. We don't dispute them. Those facts alone are insufficient to show that the recovery fund is liable. He then went on and made what I characterize as an opening statement describing his claim and why he thought the recovery fund was liable. He introduced no evidence, nobody testified, no documents were introduced. In his opening statement, he even made the statement concerning the application of Section 15, Subsection 3 of the statute to Ms. Graham's acts.
I presume all of this is in the record.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm paraphrasing from what the transcript of the recovery fund here. He said, we can prove and will prove that, a violation of 15.3 by Ms. Graham. Of course, he didn't offer any evidence to prove anything, and that subsection is inconsistent with his theory of recovery in this case. He asserted that we could not collaterally attack the judgment, that we were bound by it. I did not object to the court taking judicial notice. The judge never took judicial notice of anything. And the three specific facts that were indicated, I had no objection to. I did object to the trial court taking any position or making any decision that the state was bound at the time the entry of that judgment occurred. For I do not believe that's what the statute requires. The court ordered us to pay, and we appealed. In the Court of Appeals, they again asserted that we were bound and could not collaterally attack the judgment. Although the Court of Appeals affirmed the decision of the trial court, it did not base its decision on the collateral attack theory. It found that the court had taken judicial notice of all the facts of the case and that I had waived that error by not objecting.
What do you contend the requirements of taking judicial notice are?
Judicial notice, as I understand it, is reserved for, under the rules of civil evidence, for facts not subject to reasonable dispute, generally known, capable of accurate and ready determination. One case called them notorious facts, the absolute truth of which cannot be disputed. For example, the city of Jacksonville, Texas is in Cherokee County, or Dallas is in Dallas County, or that there is, that the countryside contains rolling plains. In this case, the court has been allowed to take judicial notice of all the facts, and specifically one issue that is crucial to this recovery fund claim is what acts, if any, Ms. Graham performed in the capacity of a real estate broker.
Well, let's say we're talking about something of which the court could take judicial notice. Do you have a contention as to whether or not the judge complied with the procedure necessary to do so in this case?
Well, in the Hood case, the court pointed out that even if the court could have taken judicial notice in that case, there was nothing in the record to indicate that it did. The court did not take judicial notice in this case. The judge never said a word, and I didn't think that the court had taken judicial notice, and of course the rules of civil evidence authorize the opportunity, even after notice is taken, for to be heard on the question.
Was the judgment in evidence, or was it disputed?
No, the judgment is not disputed. We would concede that, and I think the court did take judicial notice.
What else
do
you think he needs to put into evidence?
Well, the judgment doesn't say anything. It just says Fontaine Graham is liable. It doesn't indicate the ground. It doesn't indicate what she did. The petition in this case and the underlying cause and the judgment in this case do not show anything that would entitle payment from the fund. It just says she's liable. And, of course, in most cases, that's all the judgments say.
Let me clear up this. I'm trying to hurriedly read the act. Are the only times a recovery is authorized from the fund is when there has been an act committed within the purview of Section 15, 3 or 4? Are those the only times when you can recover money from the fund?
That's correct, Your Honor. The person has to be acting under 15.3 in his own name as a principal in a real estate transaction, and 4, which is now 6, deals with performing an act constituting a broker or salesman and then guilty of a laundry list of misconduct that's listed in Section 15.
Would it be a fair summary then of your contentions that there is no evidence that Fontaine Graham did any act proscribed by either Section 3 or then Section 4?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. If the state is going to be bound everything that went on in the underlying cause at the moment that judgment is entered, how are we to ensure that the requirements of Section 8 are met? Let me cite a quick example. Suppose the court in the underlying cause makes a finding that the defendant is a licensed broker. They file their application, they contact the commission checks its files and learns that that defendant had never been licensed as a real estate agent. In other words, the court's finding is wrong. And, of course, the reason it's wrong, probably, is that the only entity that knows who's licensed is the Texas Real Estate Commission. And it's not a party to that underlying cause and never was asked. Now, if we're bound by that finding in that underlying judgment, then we'll have to pay out of the recovery fund. And yet this statute says we can't pay unless the defendant was a licensed broker. If we're to be bound, then we are being denied the opportunity to see that the recovery fund requirements are met. Specifically in this case, I'd like to provide the court with copies of both sets of findings in this case. The findings on your left are the findings after the underlying cause resulted in a judgment. They're dated in April of 86. On your right are the findings after the recovery fund hearing, and they're dated in December of 86. Now, they're largely identical, and I'll be referring primarily to those on your right after the recovery fund hearing, but I'd like to highlight for you some of the problems that I see with these specific findings in this case if we are to be bound by the judgment in this cause. Finding number 16 and finding number 21 finds that Fontaine Graham committed acts.
Which one are we on?
On the findings
April
on your right,
page 3.
It's December of 86, on your right, page 3 and page 4. Finding 16 on page 3 and finding 21 on page 4 say that Fontaine Graham committed acts which were the proximate and producing cause of damage to the estate, and that those acts were committed in both capacities. as an executor and as a real estate broker. Now, if she performed the same acts in both capacities at the same time, I submit that the executor capacity, that is, the executive capacity, must prevail or must dominate. If she could wear both hats at the same time, the executor hat, the exempt hat, must be on top, because the statute says if you're an executor, you're exempt. You can't act as a broker. You can't violate the statute. It can't be applied to you. This finding, I submit, leads to a conclusion that the fund cannot be liable, because there isn't any indication that she acted in a capacity that is not exempt. On
now,
page...
What was your authority for saying she cannot act as an agent while she's acting as executrix?
Section 3 of the statute exempts.
You're talking about the Real Estate...
Real Estate License Act, Section 3. It states that the following persons and transactions are hereby exempted from the provisions of this act, and the provisions of this act shall not apply to the following persons and transactions, to wit. And then it lists, and in 4 and 5 you have executor appointed by the court under the authority of a will, items that they concede she had the authority to act under. And since she was an executor and since she was exempt, none of the provisions of the statute can be applied to her.
But if she acted in both capacities and you take one away, don't you have the other one left?
No, because if you're exempt, you can't act as a broker. Because in order to act as a broker, you have to perform an act that's defined in Section 2 as a broker. But Section 3 says that if you act in an exempt capacity, none of the provisions of the act can be applied to you. That's the purpose of the exemption, is to let people act as an executor, for example, and sell real property, which without that capacity, without that exempt or executor capacity, they would need a real estate license for. And they're saying you don't need a license, and none of the provisions of the statute can be applied to you if you fit an exemption.
Counsel, so what was the original purpose of this Recovery Act?
The original purpose was to protect the public. And the statute, I believe, has been practically handled and followed and has protected the public. We've paid $2 million out of the recovery fund since it was established. And in fact, the reason we haven't paid more is because there's a limit of $20,000 per transaction and $50,000 per licensee.
Wasn't it also the purpose of this recovery fund to recover real estate agents since they were able to successfully lobby themselves out from under coverage of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act when it was passed in 1973?
Your Honor, I believe that's correct. This statute does cover the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And I'd like to tell the court that we pay 80% of these claims by agreed order without any contest whatsoever. We don't come in here and say, the broker's Lily White, he hasn't done anything wrong, prove it. We look at the findings or the judgment or the petition, and we determine what they showed, and we ascertain whether or not first they were licensed, whether they committed acts that fit within the statute, and then third, whether or not they were performing in the capacity that's covered. In this case, the only contention we have is that she didn't act and could not act in a capacity that's covered by the fund. And that's really our only point of contention.
Well, isn't there a conflict of interest? If you are acting as an executor, you're subject to some liabilities under the probate code. You may dispose of the assets of the estate and you're eligible for a 5% sales price or commission. But then if you are also trying to be a broker, it seems to me that there's conflict of interest. Is that the reason for the exemption?
Well, the exemption, I think, is at least initially to authorize people to act in these capacities who aren't licensed. Yeah. But the statute goes farther than that and makes it absolute. I don't know if there's a conflict or not. It seems to me in this case, Ms. Graham, when she was selling the estate's real property, was really, while she was acting for the estate, she was the estate. And I don't think that she could act as a broker, because to act as a broker, you have to act for another person. And she was the estate through the executor authority. And if you don't act for another person, you're not acting as a broker. You don't need a license. And we couldn't take her license away, for example, if under that authority. Now, we could take it away under the 15.3 acting in your own name authority. In this case, we don't think we could, because she's exempt. And if she's exempt, we can't apply the provisions that would authorize us to take her license.
You're saying it's impossible for her to act in both capacities.
Because of the exemption. in reference to this estate and its real property. That's exactly correct.
The only capacity in which she could act would be that of an executive.
That's correct, because of the exemption. Finding of fact 20 on page 4 finds that Fontaine Graham was negligent in her handling of the estate, and her negligence was the proximate cause of the damage to the estate. I submit that that finding on its face leads to a conclusion that the fund cannot be liable. Negligence in handling the affairs of the estate is not the act of a real estate broker. Therefore, the fund shouldn't be liable under that finding. Back to finding 16 on page 3 at the bottom and the top of page 4. There are descriptions of damages and specific dollar amounts listed. We see notes, loans to Fontaine Graham from the Neal estate listed. Borrowing money from an estate is not the act of a real estate broker. And even if Ms. Graham was guilty of fraud in borrowing money or loaning money to herself, essentially, and not paying it back, she wasn't performing as a real estate agent in that capacity. This fact, again, leads to a conclusion that the fund is not liable. Finally, finding of fact 12, and I will refer you both to the findings after the underlying cause on your left, and the finding number 12, the same number from the findings after the recovery fund, the same number and essentially the same language, but in the first two lines there's a change. After the cause resulted in a judgment against Ms. Graham, the finding reads, Fontaine Graham was hired for a fee by the estate to manage the real property, and it goes on. After the recovery fund hearing, that finding has been changed in the first line, and it now says Fontaine Graham was hired as a real estate broker for a fee by the estate to manage the property. The phrase, as a real estate broker, has been added. Where does it come from? It can't come from the recovery fund hearing because there's no evidence at the recovery fund hearing. It can't come from the underlying cause because the findings after that cause don't have that phrase. And yet that phrase makes their claim look a little bit stronger, like she could have acted as a real estate broker. Mr. Hicks is quoted in the transcript as stating that if Mr. Warner were aware of the facts of this case and the findings of this court, he would realize why the facts of this case and the findings of this court fit within the scope, meaning that the fund is liable. How am I supposed to be aware of the facts of the case? I thought that was the purpose of the recovery fund hearing. But at the recovery fund hearing, it is his position that it's already over, that I'm bound, that my lips are sealed. So at the first and only opportunity for the state to know the facts, it is his position that we can't know the facts, and he isn't going to tell us. And he even states in the transcript that it is not up to him to give me the facts of this case, and that it's no accident that he proved what he thought he needed to bind the state in the underlying cause. I submit that it is up to him to give the facts of the case to the court at the recovery fund hearing, when the state is a party, in order to meet the requirements of this statute. If we bind the state by everything that's gone on before, then we change the legislature's attempt to streamline these procedures and turn it into a steam roller that flattens the state's ability to show why, state's ability to show, to prove, to be sure that the requirements for payment have been met.
Mr. Warner.
Yes, sir.
Look to finding of fact 14 in your December.
Yes.
Why isn't the conduct set out in that finding conduct that would fall under section 15, paragraph 3?
I think, Your Honor,
represented to the estate while acting as exclusive selling and leasing agent. That's conduct of a broker there, not of an executrix or administrator.
Well, I think, first of all, because of the exemption, you can't act as a broker, period, in relation to that estate. So she couldn't act as a broker no matter what she did, because she was the estate in handling the real property.
At first, I asked you, I thought I had this understanding with you. You were saying that there was no evidence of any conduct proscribed by section 15, sub 3 or sub 4, now you're falling back on the position that because she was an administratrix or an executrix, and that's exempt under the act, that nothing she could have done would have been an act of a real estate agent. So what is your position?
At the recovery fund hearing, there's no evidence, period. I don't really know what the evidence was at the underlying cause. I wasn't there. I do see this finding. But if you look at the other findings, it's my position that these findings, when you read them all, they are inconsistent, they're contradictory, they're incomplete, and on their face show that she didn't, because it says she was negligent handling the estate. That's not the actual broker.
Are you saying now that there's more than one reason why the fund shouldn't be tapped? Or are you saying that simply because acts of an executrix are exempt, the fund shouldn't be tapped?
I'm making 2 points. First of all, I don't think she could act as a broker because of the exemption. But the second point is, I don't think that she did, because these findings, in my opinion, are inconsistent and contradictory.
How do you get around finding 14?
How do we get around finding 16 and finding 21? It says she was performing acts that caused approximate and producing cause of the damage, was negligent from handling the estate. That's not the act of the broker. These findings, after the underlying cause, were requested by the plaintiffs, not by the defendant, by the winner, in other words. I think that what happens in these cases is they think they can bind the state by what happens at the underlying cause, so they, whether by evidence or whether by findings, they put what they think they need in there to get to the fund. Finding 14, I submit, is inconsistent with 16, it's inconsistent with 21, and it's inconsistent to in the sense that how do we know which, if they're inconsistent, if they're contradictory, which is correct? And it seems to me that in the underlying cause, the focus was not on Ms. Graham's act as a broker. In other words, the fact that she was licensed had absolutely nothing to do with her liability in that underlying cause. If she hadn't been licensed at all, they could have gotten the same judgment against her. That finding that she acted as a broker is not the issue in the underlying cause. But it's a crucial issue when you get to the recovery fund hearing. And of course, at that hearing, we need to see that the requirements are met, one of which is she was acting in a capacity to recover. And it's only at that recovery fund hearing that that issue is important.
Yeah, there was a reporter present taking down the recovery fund hearing. Is that right?
Yes, there was. And that's in the transcript, it's in the record.
And your contention is the only request for judicial notice was as to the judgment in the underlying suit.
The amount and the date, that's my contention. And the judge never said anything. He never took judicial notice.
You contend that Mr. Hicks did not request the judge to take judicial notice of the findings of fact in the underlying suit.
I don't think the record will show that he did. I think he will argue that he did. I don't think the transcript shows that. But I submit that these findings should not bind the state without something at the recovery fund hearing to show what they're based on. Otherwise, the state is not going to be able to see that the requirements for payment are met. If we're bound by what went on before, every judgment in Texas against a real estate broker will have three things in it. It will have that she was licensed, that she performed in a capacity that the fund is liable for, and then how many transactions were involved in order to get the maximum amount. Every suit will have that in the judgment. And the state will not be able to do anything about it but cut the check. And if we do that, then what do we make of the language in this Section 8 that says the burden's on him at the recovery fund hearing? What do we make of the language in the statute that says that he has to show that his judgment is based on facts? What do we make of the language in the statute that says the court must be satisfied that all of the requirements for payment out of the fund have been met? And what do we make of the language in Part 5 that says the state has the authority to defend the recovery fund action? If we say we're bound by what went on before, we can take our blackout marker and scratch all of that out of the statute because it's not there anymore. That's not what the legislature intended. They wanted to streamline these procedures, but they didn't want to take away the state's ability to make sure, to ensure, that the requirements for payment had been met. And all we contest in these cases is not every fact, but simply the facts pertaining to whether the requirements can be met.
Thank you. We are now ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I take the floor? Mr. Larry Hicks will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Larry Hicks, and I'm here representing the appellees in this cause, the Nagel family. This case is a very simple case. It is the most egregious example of overreaching on the part of the Texas Attorney General's Office and Real Estate Commission that I've seen in a long time. This is a case where Fontaine Graham was the executor of this estate. She was all, and this is all shown in the findings of fact. She was the executor of the estate. She was also hired by the estate to be a real estate broker. She was paid a trustee's fee. She was paid a real estate broker's fee all the way through this transaction. She served in both capacities. Mr. Warner would have you...
Did she name herself, or did she have court approval?
She was independent executor of the estate. And
so she named herself to be the real estate
as the broker.
Do you think she could do that?
Well, in fact, the trust instrument itself asked that her agency, which was this goes back a long way, but previously the agency that she worked for was Coles Brothers Agency, which Coles were related to Miss Ricks, the trustor. Her trust instrument asked that the Coles agency be the exclusive broker for the property that belonged to the estate. And then she then became the successor of the Coles agency. So that's how it all happened. She didn't actually appoint herself. She was appointed through that mechanism.
Can she collect both the real estate broker's fee and the executor's fee?
Well, whether she can or not, she did. And whether she can or not certainly was part of the underlying lawsuit that was involved in this case. You know, this entire case is based on the fact that the Attorney General's office believes that the Real Estate Commission is entitled to a trial de novo. If that's true, then what Mr. Warner is saying here today, that the purpose of this is to streamline this act, is exactly the opposite. They're asking for a brand new evidentiary hearing on the facts of the case. What is Mrs. Graham going to do at the hearing? Is she going to come in here and refute what the findings of fact were at the trial court? She can't do that. She's bound. They are collaterally stopped from coming in and trying this case again. Now, where do I get my authority for that? The Act itself states that the Real Estate Commission shall come in on behalf of and in the name of the broker. On behalf of and in the name of the broker. They come in as a subrogee of the broker, who is the defendant in the underlying action. Mr. Warner says, but we didn't know anything about the facts of the case. The Act specifically says that in Section 8, Part 3, that the broker shall notify the Real Estate Commission as soon as a lawsuit is filed against them, which may be subject to the Act, which may be subject to the fund. Not that it will be, or it's definite that it will be. She may say this isn't going to be subject to the fund, but she has an obligation. It says shall notify the Real Estate Commission. The Real Estate Commission knew or should have known at the time that this lawsuit was filed that there was a potential claim out there, that they could monitor if they chose to do so, that they could be aware of the facts if they chose to do so. They chose not to do that, assuming they had notice. If they didn't have notice, then are we going to make claimants who, first of all, are defrauded by this woman? They come in there, they have to go through the expense and the ordeal of a trial. The findings of fact are determined that she acted in both capacities, not one or the other, but in both capacities, and they're determined that she's entitled to recover under the fund. Are we then going to say, well, claimants, you have to retry this case because the Attorney General didn't get their chance at it? We're going to give them two bites at the apple? That's not streamlined.
Well, the fund is going to give you a recovery for her acts as an independent executive?
No, ma'am. The fund cannot, and I agree with Mr. Warner on this, it cannot recover for her acts as an executrix, but it can give recovery for her acts as a broker. And she was doing both things. Mr. Warner and Justice Kilgarland pointed out appropriately, she acted as the rental agent and the leasing agent of the real estate owned by the trust. during this whole time. And she earned commissions and was paid commissions for that the whole time. The findings of fact indicate that.
Do you agree with Mr. Warner that the only way you can recover is by proving conduct on her part that falls under Section 15, sub 3 and 4?
Yes, sir. I don't disagree with that at all. I think that that's exactly right. What I disagree with Mr. Warner about, though, is that it's the obligation of the applicant to come in and retry that case. All the applicant has to do is to put on facts that show that the judge that the fund applied, and that's exactly what we did. We took the court took judicial notice. The entire case, the entire requirements at the hearing, was determined by judicial notice or by stipulation, and I'll point it out to you. The pages 1 through 4 of the statement of facts set out the entire, almost the entire deal. In fact, everything that you need is in there, pages 1 through 4 of the statement of facts. The very first question out of my mouth at that hearing was, does the court have the file? Do you have the court's file in front of you? The judge says yes. And then for 4 pages, we go on and we're pointing out things, and it's evident by reading that transcript that the court is going through the file as I'm pointing out the various facts, going through the judgment, the findings of fact, the conclusions of law, the interrogatory answers, the judgment that was filed of record, nulla bona, all of that stuff. He was going through that. It's evident by the way that this is, by the way that the language is here. I ask, most of what I'm going to allege, as you are aware, in the application order directing payment of the real estate recovery fund arising out of the judgment was taken in this adversary proceeding involving Font Van Graham as respondent. Most of the evidence I'm going to put on is going to be evidence that comes out of the court's file. So I'm going to ask the court to take judicial notice of certain facts as required. I specifically ask it. Mr. Warner in his brief says, how are we supposed to know when to object? The court didn't make a ruling. Well, the court made a ruling when he ordered them to pay.
Well, how did they do this without a hearing, like the statement on 6 on the last page, the Real Estate Commission has not shown that complainant's recovery of their judgment against Fontaine Graham is from the real estate recovery fund is spurious and unjust. When did they prove that?
Where are you?
On your December 17th, last page, number 6. When did you prove
that? 6 and 7. When was that proven? That was proven at the time of trial. It's included in the findings of fact that were determined at the time of trial. Another interesting point is that the Real Estate Commission on this appeal didn't even put the record of the trial court before this court for appellate review. It's not even here. The only thing they have is the transcript of the hearing. The only reason the findings of fact from the trial court are in here is because I put it in the record. They didn't even put the appropriate record in front of you all for review.
What are you saying that they did not bring forward?
I'm saying that what occurred at the trial court, they didn't even bring before the court. The court is not, the court can take judicial notice of anything that occurred at an ancillary proceeding in that case. And that's exactly what he did.
You're saying we have no statement of facts in this case?
I'm saying, yes, sir, we have no statement of facts at the underlying trial in this case. The only
what were you reading from a moment ago? Then?
This is the statement of facts of the hearing, the application hearing only.
But there wasn't any testimony then.
Pardon me?
There wasn't any testimony.
Right. There was no testimony at the hearing. Exactly. But there's no trial court testimony in here at all. There's nothing.
There's no statement of facts from the initial hearing
by the estate
against Fontaine Graham.
Yes, sir. And that is the point from which these findings of fact were determined in the first instance. All we did at the hearing is we brought these facts forward to the court. The court could take judicial notice of the facts. The court was the finder of fact at the trial court level and could take judicial notice of those facts, which he did.
How does the record reflect that he took judicial notice?
The record reflects it in that he was asked to take judicial notice. There was no objection on the part of Mr. Warner, and he ultimately held in favor of the respondents and came up with the findings of fact and conclusions of law to the hearing.
He was asked to take judicial notice of what?
Of Well, I'll
find
of everything
made in the previous case.
Of everything. The only facts, I'm reading from page 2 of the statement of facts of the hearing. The only facts that are not proven by documents that are in the record is the fact that the complainants are not spouses of the defendant, and I can, if necessary, take the stand and so testify. Mr. Warner says, we'll stipulate that. He says on page 5, we're not here to dispute or contest Ms. Graham's relationship with the plaintiff in terms of whether she was a spouse or the amount of the judgment or that she's insolvent. Those are other requirements. He said earlier that there was absolutely nothing. They stipulated to that too. They stipulated to the facts that she's not a spouse of the licensee, which was required. They stipulated the final judgment, the amount of judgment, that she was insolvent. They stipulated that. All of that stuff was also proven by taken by judicial notice by the court.
What is it clear that what claim you are asking this fund to reimburse the estate? What is the amount you're asking of it?
$50,000 is the amount, and that was the amount that the court determined in the order on the application.
That's statutory limit.
That's established statutory limit, yes, sir. Now,
on this judicial notice. Now, the rule very clearly states that a court may take judicial notice whether requested to or not. So it's strictly within the discretion of the trial court whether he will take judicial notice of adjudicated facts. And that's set out in B of Rule of Evidence 201, not subject to reasonable dispute in that it is either generally known within the jurisdiction of the trial court or capable of accurate and ready determination by resort to sources whose accuracy cannot reasonably be questioned.
That's right.
So he has a file in his office, in his court, of which he has personal knowledge of what went on in the court below, and you're contending that 2 under 201B very clearly gives him the right to take judicial notice of that file, those proceedings in court below.
Absolutely.
He has a right to take judicial notice whether he requested to or not, so he could have done it even though you hadn't requested it.
Absolutely. And he and they are stopped to go in and try to disprove the facts that were already found. Mr. Warner says that there's no reason for this hearing if the judge is just going to rubber stamp. That's not true, because there are certainly instances where the facts of the underlying case don't apply. So just having a judgment doesn't automatically say that the fund that goes into effect, the facts may or may not apply. And that's the purpose of the hearing, is to go in there and show the facts and say, now, did these facts apply to the fund?
Well, certainly you'd have to prove up insolvency in the second hearing.
Right.
It would not be relevant or material in the first.
Correct. And insolvency can be proven by judicial notice, even though it was stipulated in this case. Could have been proven by judicial notice by looking at the judgment that was returned null and void. And also, in this case, there were interrogatory responses stipulated, signed, and sworn to by Ms. Graham saying, I have no assets.
Now,
they're in the record also.
Record that she notified the commission?
That she notified the commission?
You said that she was supposed to.
We notified
them. You notified them.
Yes.
Evidence.
Yes,
did you notify?
Yes, ma'am. And that's all of that is in the file also.
At the first instance, the first hearing?
The application hearing, yes.
Not the application.
Oh, no, there's no evidence that she knows. Oh, I understand. I'm sorry. I misunderstood your question. No evidence that I know of that.